You are listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 11th of August 2022 on Monocle 24.
The latest last-ditch attempt to revive the Iran nuclear deal. Has Europe been slower to find new energy sources than Russia has been to find new energy customers? And New Zealand's hopes of hauling its tourist business dramatically upmarket. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Nabila Ramdani and Stephen DL will discuss all the day's big stories, and our On This Day historical series will reflect on the perils of trying to be funny when you're President of the United States. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by the journalist and broadcaster Nabila Ramdani and by Stephen DL, the writer, broadcaster and Russia analyst. Hello to you both. Welcome back.
Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening, everyone.
And as we have already menaced, if not promised, our listeners, we will start with the Iran nuclear deal, entered into by US President Barack Obama in 2015 and flounced out of by US President Donald Trump in 2018, which means that efforts to revive it have now been going on longer than the deal in its first incarnation lasted. The latest, and this might be the last, is that EU officials have presented to the US and Iran what they describe as a take it or leave it final text. In an entrancing subplot, meanwhile, the US Department of Justice has laid charges against a member of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps pertaining to an alleged plot to assassinate former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Stephen, let's assume that we are here in the last-ditch take-it-or-leave-it stages of this. Do we imagine that ultimately Iran is actually going to decide, all right, we've had as much fun with this as we're going to be able to, let's sign up?
The language that's come out so far suggests that it's not definite that they're going to do that. For example, they said, well, the EU doesn't have the authority to put forward a final agreement. And, you know, we're going to have to look at it very carefully. So that suggests that either they're playing games or and then they're going to turn around and say, yes, OK, we'd like to have a deal because we'd like sanctions to be eased. Or they may just say, we don't care what you think, and we're going to carry on as we like with our nuclear program.
Because, Nabila, there have always been, I think, various levels of bluff, double bluff, and counter bluff going on around this deal. And one of the key questions, to which I'm not sure anybody has an entirely satisfactory answer, possibly not even the Iranians themselves, which is, does Iran actually, deep down where it lives, want a nuclear weapon? I mean, surely they would understand that for them, it would cause at least as many problems as it might solve.
Well, let's put it that way. I mean, Iran officials are determinedly rejecting abandoning their nuclear program altogether. And they essentially claim that it's for civilian use and it's perfectly right and proper to have a nuclear program as other countries have, not least of all in the region where Iran is. But let's not be under any illusion that this situation is horrendously complicated. Patience is very obviously running very thin on both sides. Iran wants to expand its nuclear program, and in return, they want a downscaling of, the other side, they want to downscale. He wants an ease on the sanctions imposed on the country, imposed by the West in general, the US, the UN, the EU, pretty much everybody is imposing sanctions on Iran at the moment. As you said, the deal was famously or infamously abandoned by Donald Trump and his administration. But it's very clear that the EU is determined to have the two sides, meaning essentially the US and Iran, working together. Now, there seems to be different conflicting stories coming out of that Vienna conference. The EU is claiming that they're very, very close indeed to sealing a deal. Well, Iran is very much like, oh, hang on a minute, we don't like certain clauses in it. And the EU is saying, well, you know, you can't, you know, agree with 20 pages and reject one page. You have to agree to the whole package, otherwise it's not going to work for everyone involved. So it's a very fraught fraught situation.
Indeed, it is that, Stephen. We will be talking a bit later in the show about the merits or otherwise of extremely blunt diplomatic language. Are we reaching the point at which there might be a case for it here? As in, how big a risk would the other parties to the deal be taking if they said to Iran, not merely take it or leave it, but seriously, all right, then fine. You can spend the rest of your life buckling under sanctions. And if you try and build a nuclear weapon, see how that goes for you.
That is an approach they could take. It's an approach that certain Americans might take, but I can't see the European Union doing that. And of course, one of the reasons being that the European Union is not a country, and therefore each of the individual countries might have different opinions on that. But it is the European Union that seems to be saying, oh, yeah, we've got a deal, we've got a deal. Whereas, as Nabila says, the Iranians are saying, well, I'm not sure we have. So I wouldn't hold my breath on this one. I also get the impression, obviously, you know, because I'm a Russia watcher, and I've often quoted the phrase that, you know, Russia is like Millwall Football Club in South London, whose phrase is, you don't like us, we don't care. And it seems to me that that could be applied to Iran as well.
Well, indeed so. There's another potentially hilarious trajectory here, Nabila, of course, which is, and I'm sure if this has occurred to me, it has occurred to the Iranians, that they could sign a deal. The United States could re-elect Donald Trump or another Republican president, not so far away from now, and America could withdraw from it all over again. That being a not at all unlikely prospect, does that make Iran more or less likely to sign? Because they would be torn between thinking, well, what's the point in signing this? It might be torn up again in 2 years. And thinking, well, if we do sign it now, then we at least get a 2 year or so hiatus from sanctions. We get a little bit of relief.
Well, I think the priority for Iran is obviously to get some relief from the sanctions. It's a country that wants to move on, catch up with the rest of the world, and those sanctions are crippling. And as usual, sanctions are, hit ordinary people the hardest, not necessarily regimes or governments we disagree with. But I think in the long term, this situation has to improve for the sake of, dare I say, peace and stability for not just the region, but the rest of the world. That's how serious this Iran deal really is. I think, you know, regional tensions have been at boiling point in the region for over many years. And there's an entire nexus of complicated alliance with on both sides involved. And it wouldn't be much of an exaggeration to suggest that a nuclear war could be threatened unless some kind of compromise and indeed improvement is found.
But Andrew, the point you made there, they actually did say, apparently, according to the reports, the Iranians said to the Americans, will you make sure that this can't be overturned by a future administration? And the Americans kind of shrugged their shoulders, difficult to do on radio, and said, well, no, we can't, because it's not an actual treaty, it's an agreement. So the present administration can't tie in any future administration. So they are concerned about that idea, that they might sign it and 2 years down the line it might get torn up again.
Well, we will follow that story as it unfolds over coming days. But on the subject of Russia, while Russia is at the risk of tempting fate, only properly at war with one European country, it is engaged in a game of chicken with the rest of the continent. Since Russia launched its current assault on Ukraine, the EU has scrambled to detach itself from Russia's energy supplies and thereby stop funding Russia's onslaught to the tune of €1 billion a day. Russia, meanwhile, has made threats of various subtlety to turn off the taps at a time of its own choosing, potentially making a likely looming cold, dark and expensive winter even colder, darker and costlier. Russian crude oil production, crucially, has now returned almost to pre-war levels. Stephen, as you mentioned, you are a Russia watcher. Between Russia and the EU, who does seem likeliest to blink first?
Again, I go back to what I said earlier about the EU, because, of course, it's not a single country. So the danger is, I think it is a danger too, that certain individual countries, I'm not going to name any now because I don't want to sort of preempt what leaders might do, but if the EU doesn't act...
Well, a couple of them, Hungary most notably, are being pretty rickety already.
Okay, well, Hungary has decided...
We can name Hungary.
Right, we can name Hungary. I would also, since we've... All right, we're naming. I have a question mark against Germany. because Germany has made itself far too dependent on Russian energy. It also has the particularly odious former Chancellor, Herr Schröder, who is has been in Putin's pocket for many years now. That it's easier for Russia not to blink, as it were, than certain European countries to blink. But what I would really love to see across Europe is the individual administrations in various countries being honest and open with their populations and saying, look, you know, there are tough times ahead. They all seem so, certainly in Britain, they're so caught up at the moment. They're caught up with a leadership election for the who's going to be the next prime minister and saying, well, we're not going to do anything about energy until we know who the next prime minister is in 3 weeks' time, which is pretty pathetic. But in any case, they should be getting people ready to the idea that, look, what's going on in Ukraine could spread to other parts of Europe. It's a real war. It's entirely Russia's aggression that started it. We may have to bite the bullet and put up with some hardship during the winter. And I don't think it's being said enough. I'll stop there on that one.
Nabil, one of the ways that Russia has been able to adjust is by finding other markets for its energy. It has found ready customers in China, India and various other places, the Middle East and Africa in particular. And we were talking on the shows earlier this week about Anthony Blinken, US Secretary of State's tour of Africa to try and shore up support there. Did Europe, when it first started to impose sanctions on Russia, not unreasonably, rather overestimate the solidarity it could expect from the Middle East and Africa? There seems to be a certain amount of surprise that quite a lot of the rest of the world has looked at Russia's attack on Ukraine and just sort of gone, well, it's nothing to do with us.
Yes, and I think, you know, you see a great groundswell of support amongst public opinion in the West that Russia is on the retreat and that the sovereign state of Ukraine is resisting successfully with all its might. And that may well be true in the ground war. But I think as far as the sanctions war is concerned, it is much harder to be over-optimistic. And I think Putin has successfully managed to weaponize energy and energy supply to try and win this war at all costs. I think, you know, he undoubtedly holds massive energy assets and he can play the markets to fund his invasion of the Ukraine, and that there is no doubt that his country is still earning billions through Russia's control of energy supplies. And meanwhile, what we're seeing in Europe is that Europe is getting into huge difficulties as sanctions against Russian crude oil, for example, start to bite in. And it seems to actually be the reverse, that effectively Europe is being punished rather than Russia. And it seems that the people suffering the most from all this are Western Europeans. We've seen how UK energy prices are well on the way towards jumping by 75%, while in Germany, utility companies are already warning of 100% increases once the summer ends and we move towards the summer. So, I think, you know, the weaponization of energy supplies by Putin has proved quite successful.
But this is why the Western countries need to be so strong, because this is not simply a financial question. Putin might be getting billions of dollars a day for his energy, or a billion a day probably, but that doesn't provide him with more weaponry, because the sanctions that are really biting are the ones that provide the clever gadgets, the chips and so on, which actually Russian weaponry production is now dependent on. And so they've run short of, particularly their clever weapons that Putin's been boasting about so much in recent years. They've resorted to a lot of Soviet-era equipment, both in terms of the tanks and the artillery and the shells that the artillery fire and so on. They have got a problem. So that's number one. There's a problem with the weaponry, however much money they've got, and that's not going to go away if sanctions remain as they are. And also, something which I have said a million times before, the thing that has always frightened Putin most of all is an uprising from below. And what is happening, particularly with the younger generation, the urban younger generation in particular, is that they are now missing out on the things that they came to know and love in recent years. It's been 30 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and so they got used to living in many ways, in the urban centres, certainly Moscow, St. Petersburg, Yekaterinburg, the biggest cities, they got used to having their creature comforts like their Western counterparts, and now they haven't got them. And that's going. The longer that goes on, that spreads discontent amongst people. So he still has a problem with his population.
What I would say, however, is that the nature of warfare, you know, has changed. It's not just a matter of an army defeating another army. And those tactics that Putin is using towards, you know, with energy supplies, he's doing the exact same thing with wheat supplies. You know, he's obliterating everything he possibly can in Ukraine, including its wheat and grain supply. You know, Ukraine used to be the wheat basket of Europe. Well, not anymore. And dare I say, there's nothing new in these horrendous tactics, starvation tactics, have been used in conflicts such as Yemen, Afghanistan, and the common factor is that there is a total war going on, and one side wants to win at all costs, and therefore resorts to that kind of sinister tactics. And the only solution is the end of the war. It's to find a way to stop the two sides fighting. And it's a truism, but that's the only way, to move on from this conflict. Otherwise, it could turn into a war of occupation. Russia could have boots on the ground for years to come.
Just a final quick thought on this, Stephen, and just going back to what you were saying about how a certain cohort of Russian society, those middle-class urbanites, have got used to a sort of modern 21st century idea of living these last couple of decades. Do you think Putin might be perhaps mistaken if he's banking on this idea of the stereotype of Russians having a much greater inherent ability to absorb hardship than these soppy milquetoast Western Europeans?
I think he is. Certainly the older generation, the old Soviet generation, but of course, you know, they're kind of in their 60s and 70s, many of them now, if they're still alive, because the Russians don't tend to live terribly long. But they are still, they say, yes, you know, our grandparents and parents got through the war and we will get through as well. But the younger generation is different. And that is something that I think he's wary of. Also, for example, the fact that he hasn't declared it as a war. I know he said at the start it's a special military operation.
Yeah.
Well, one reason why he hasn't declared it as a war, because if he declared it as a war, that's a real shock to people. Oh, my God, we are actually at war. He could then have a mass mobilization, but he doesn't know how that mass mobilization is going to go. There have been significant instances already of serving soldiers either refusing to go back to Ukraine, the National Guard, which he's set up as a kind of almost a militarized police force within the country. There have been many instances where they've said, well, we're not going there. That's not what we're here for. You know, we're here to look after the security inside the country. So there has been dissent, if you like, in that sense. And he doesn't know how deep that is or how far that might go.
Stephen Dial and Nabil Aramdani, thanks for the moment. We will have more from you later in the show. But now on The Daily, it is time for our On This Day historical segment, which this week reflects on what can nearly go very badly wrong when a president of the United States tries to be funny. There is nothing at all wrong with a national leader having a sense of humour. Indeed, it is a virtue to be encouraged. A person who is able to sit at the apex of government, bear the tremendous burdens associated, and still maintain any sense of the absurd is doing something right. However, there's a time and a place, and as we discovered on this day 38 years ago, minutes before addressing your fellow citizens of one superpower at a moment of acute tension with another superpower is arguably not it.
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
On the morning of August 11th, 1984, US President Ronald Reagan was holidaying at his California ranch, but nevertheless preparing to record his weekly radio address.
cut off at your...
The sound engineers from National Public Radio had asked him to say something to test the levels. Reagan was neither the first nor last person in such a position to amuse themselves and the audio crew by saying something that they would not say into a microphone they knew to be live. Reagan did this kind of thing pretty frequently and cannot have been entirely surprised when this particular quip leaked. A couple of years previously, in similar circumstances, preparing to deliver a measured critique of Poland's then military dictatorship, he'd warmed up by saying, "My fellow Americans, the leaders of the Polish government are a bunch of no good lousy bums." Which, while it was accurate in every respect, is not really the sort of rhetorical platform upon which lasting détente can be built. However, there was no real reason to care circa the early 1980s what Poland thought about anything, given that Poland of that period did not think anything it had not been given permission to think by the Soviet Union. But there was a great deal of reason to care circa the early 1980s what the Soviet Union thought. TASS, the Soviet news agency, conveyed the Kremlin's displeasure with Reagan's joshing thus.
"This kind of behavior is incompatible with the great responsibility borne by heads of nuclear states for the destinies of their own people and mankind."
The media of the United States' European allies was scarcely more impressed, much of the reporting of Reagan's gag suggesting that here was proof, were it needed, that Reagan struggled to distinguish the real world from the hack westerns in which he had once starred.
"You wanted law and order in this town. You've got it. I'll shoot the first man who starts for those steps. Come on!"
And it might have been worse. A few months later, NBC News reported that a few days after Reagan's jape had emerged, an officer serving in the Soviet Union's Far Eastern Command in Vladivostok had transmitted a coded message which informed Soviet forces that they were now at war with the United States.
"The code was instantly broken by U.S. and Japanese intelligence. This is what then happened. A special command unit in Ussuriysk went on wartime alert."
Mercifully, it seems to have occurred to a good few Soviet Navy captains to call back to base, asking variations on "where what now?" and to US forces to wait and see if the Soviets did anything launchy before they got too excited. Within 30 minutes, the alert was rescinded, amid some suggestion that there may have been an almost heartwarmingly prosaic reason for it.
"One senator said the alert must have been a joke. A congressman said it was Russia's way of answering the president. Most officials said no comment. Though one did speculate that the Russian might have been drunk."
And who among us has not had a few scoops with lunch and returned to the office, vowing to rain hellfire upon our enemies? On this day in 1984, still with me on the daily are our guests Nabila Ramdani and Stephen Diel. I did want to expand a little bit on some of the themes raised in that bit. Stephen, first of all, that was obviously not for public consumption, what Reagan said there. So he wasn't advancing that as part of any diplomatic platform. But is there a time and a place for just the brisk, plain speaking? For example, Reagan's later address, famous address in Berlin, where he just said, and he'd been advised not to by his counselors, who said it was too unsubtle and too stand-takey, but just said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall."
I think there is room for it. I mean, certainly the tear down this wall, that was great, I think. But I remember very well the statement about, the bombing of Russia starts in 5 minutes. And I was a Soviet military analyst at the time. And we sort of sucking your teeth in our office. He needed to be more careful. But
was it immediately apparent to you at the time that that was a joke? There wasn't anybody thinking, but what did he mean by that?
No, we did think, oh, God, he's at it again. That's a joke. it was a little less serious. It was a British comedian called Kenny Everett who was doing a big plug for Margaret Thatcher and the Conservatives at a Conservative Party rally, and he came out with Michael Foot was then the leader of the Labour Party. And he said, let's kick Michael Foot's stick away, because he always had to walk with it with a stick. And then he thought that didn't get the laughs he wanted. So he said, let's bomb Russia. But at least he was a comedian, so that wasn't so serious. But these throwaway comments, I think the one I've always gone back to as disastrous, not in terms of the nuclear sense, but for business, was the famous comment by Gerald Ratner, who ran a chain of jewellery stores very successfully. He was a multimillionaire. He had about, I think, over 200 stores around Britain, and was asked to give an after-dinner speech. And he got up and he said, well, of course, what we sell in our stores is all crap. And that destroyed his business, because people, however hard up they might be, but they wanted to wear something glitzy and something that looked rather nice, and they're suddenly being told, well, it's crap. And it literally destroyed the business. That was a private dinner. But once that got out, wow, that, you know, it wasn't quite nuclear, but in terms of his business, it was.
I mean, Nabila, in fairness to the people who try and conduct statecraft, we do joke a lot and complain a lot about diplomatic obfuscations, but there is a reason, isn't there, why diplomacy is conducted quite often in vague or ambiguous terms. People try to allow themselves room to manoeuvre. The trouble with, as Barack Obama discovered, for example, in Syria, when you announce something is a red line, if the other party then puts their foot across it, you end up looking like a bit of an idiot if you don't act.
Yes, you do. And I have to say, I'm not too impressed by war-related soundbites, especially because they involve, you know, human life. And one should be very sensitive to that, especially when you're a world leader, and especially when you're the leader of the world's only superpower, like the United States. But I have to say that the bit we just heard about Reagan's bombing of Russia in 5 minutes sounded to me just like something out of the Doctor Strangelove movie in the 60s. And, you know, where people suddenly realise that a huge part of the world could literally be obliterated in seconds. And now, of course, we should be even more fearful of that, because we have, you know, weapons that are very, you know, capable indeed of doing just that. But you still get the feeling that many still view global war as a bit of a game, or indeed, as in your report, as a bit of a cowboy film, as probably Reagan did. So that side of things really worries me. And I think there are many people who remain a bit distanced from the real suffering that this can involve, and the appreciation of what really is going on the ground and beyond, you know, images that look as though they are straight out of a video game.
I mean, for all that, and we did talk about this a bit on the Daily yesterday, those off-mic bloopers, or those hot mic bloopers, and this may be a niche feeling enjoyed only by me. I always find them actually quite reassuring. I think I would be more upset to discover that a given leader never said anything funny when he thought he was just among friends and no one else was really listening.
Well, certainly Reagan was a character.
Way of putting it.
You know, you can't imagine, if I can, you know, quote the British example again, you can't imagine Theresa May, for example, who was Prime Minister for a while, coming out with something like that. When she was asked, what's the naughtiest thing you ever did as a girl, was running through a field of wheat. and she looked wooden, and she spoke in a wooden way. And I think maybe it's a question of getting a balance. It's far better to have someone who's got a personality, but perhaps they should rein themselves in occasionally.
There is, I think we agreed at the top of that item, a time and a place. But finally, on today's Daily, to most prospective budget travellers in Europe, New Zealand seems a daunting enough prospect already. Flights are expensive, it takes ages to get to, and even after you've arrived at the end of your long and arduous journey, your travels are burdened further by the knowledge that you could have gone to Australia instead, which is just better. However, New Zealand's tourism minister wishes to roll up the welcome mat still further where the backpacker tendency are concerned. Stuart Nash has said that his country wants tourists with money and not, as he put it, people who travel around our country on $10 a day eating two-minute noodles. Good two-minute noodles. I thought they were served at state banquets in New Zealand. Sorry, look, you can take the presenter out of Australia, etc., etc., etc. Nabila, is this fair enough? Is New Zealand I should stress, I have exaggerated Mr. Nash's position somewhat for comic effect. He wasn't actually saying backpackers stay home. He was just saying New Zealand is going to target itself more to people who have a few quid to spend.
I think that's actually a fair suggestion. It might sound controversial, but I genuinely feel...
Why do you hate poor people?
No, I do not. I think that since the coronavirus lockdowns ended, I think we've seen millions of people heading back into the skies, and there has been absolute chaos. And it would be great, I would think, if some sanity was restored in the travel industry. And the New Zealand suggestion is certainly one way of doing it. I think I welcome the plan because I think superficially it's a good idea because it would limit the amount of people wasting the world's resources and indeed putting themselves in danger in overcrowded and places and having their security threatened.
That's all fairly unlikely in New Zealand in its defence.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, you do notice nowadays when you travel, whether you go through customs on in an airport or the Eurostar, which I often take to travel back and forth to France, you do note that security is actually a bit, you know, people don't really pay much attention to your paperwork anymore. To just let anybody through.
That's reassuring. Stephen, what do you think? Should more countries follow New Zealand's lead and hang up a big sign saying no riffraff?
Definitely not. And I don't think they need to anyway, because yesterday, for example, the head of Ryanair, budget airline, one of the early budget airlines, said, well, the day of the $10 air ticket is gone anyway. So, you know, air travel is going to be more expensive. Everything's going to be more expensive. And I think that if someone wants to take a gap year as a student or before they start work or whatever, they save up and they want to put things in a backpack and go off to New Zealand. As you said at the start, it's going to cost them a small fortune to get there in the first place. And if they then want to exist on $10 a day and two-minute noodles. then fair enough. And because they also, on the serious point of view, they are probably going to appreciate the country far more than, if we're thinking rich people, a lot of rich people go on cruises. And what do cruise ships do? They sail in,
Noir of many European ports. Yeah, exactly that. Those people barge into port, get off the ship, buy a fridge magnet and get back on the ship. They don't eat or drink in the town they are visiting. They don't really interact with the local economy.
No, exactly.
But dare I say, I think the New Zealand plan, it's not advocating to keep the riffraff away. It's not also a plan designed
to... It's just much more fun if we pretend that's what they've said, Nabila. Work with me here.
It's not designed for the super rich. I think it's essentially advocating a system where people are investing in, let's say, one outstanding family holiday a year rather than jetting off every weekend. And it's not just good for ecological reasons. I think there's a lot to be said for actually budgeting for holiday and to enjoy it more. I think, you know, we have to go back to the days where we view traveling as a luxury rather than taking this for granted. It would mean that people will have to, I think it would mean essentially that traveling, in my view, also needs to be tempered, it needs to be regulated, it needs to be controlled, and pricing is always the best way of doing that.
but on the subject of investment, this is where, if I may attempt to make a semi-serious point, is where I think New Zealand might be getting this wrong, because I submit, Stephen, that it's perfectly possible that you might go to New Zealand or indeed to any country as a young person with a backpack and you might spend your $10 a day eating two-minute noodles and you might form positive associations with that country. You might think fondly of that country as you grow older and ideally more prosperous, and you might come back a few decades down the track with a few quid in your pocket and a bit more to spend.
You might even do that, or you might even say this is such a wonderful place. I know you wouldn't, but I mean, some people might say it's such a wonderful place.
I
Why don't
there.
I I come and live here? You know,
or why don't I trade with this place or do business with
this
place?
Indeed. So, I think, I hope he was, maybe he's doing a Reagan. Maybe this is a sort of tongue-in-cheek throwaway remark that someone's picked up on. I don't think so.
I want to ask you both finally, and I will ask you first, Nabila. I mean, I'm going to admit that a couple of times when I was much younger, I did do the thing of basically schlepping around Eastern Europe and the Middle East with a backpack, pretty much on $10 a day and a diet of 2-minute noodles or the local equivalent. Have you ever done any such thing?
No, for the simple reason that I was never allowed to do that by my very, caring parents.
Caring is a good word. That was the right euphemism to reach for there. Stephen, what about you? Did you ever back in the day drive a VW combi van from London to Kathmandu?
No, I didn't. Well, but what I did do is something that you very rarely see these days. I hitchhiked. I hitchhiked all the way down through France. Down to Spain. Was away for 3 weeks, so it's not a great journey. But I felt I'd achieved something as a 19 or 20 year old, I think. And in those days, you could hitchhiking. I hitchhiked all around Britain as well. But it's not something I would encourage my children to do or to have done. Now they're getting a bit old for it anyway.
Another concerned parent. Stephen DL and Nabila Ramdani, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Monocle Daily. It was produced by Chris Chermack and researched by Lillian Fawcett and Tamsin Howard. Our sound engineer was Adam Heaton with editing assistance from Emily Sands. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.